Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From AccuWeather.com, this is Everything Under the Sun. It's our weekly podcast featuring in-depth interviews with experts from AccuWeather and from around the world, bringing you behind-the-scenes information, stories, and news on the weather, climate change, and the outdoors, covering topics from the worlds of science, sports, and space. It's all the information you need to weatherproof your life. And now, here's the host of Everything Under the Sun, AccuWeather meteorologist Dean DeVore.
Friends, welcome in. We've reached the half point of meteorological spring, the halfway point of April. We've certainly been trying to get some warmer temperatures into the Northeast and the Great Lakes. We had some success this past week, but another shot of really cold air and unseasonably chilly air. So we head into this Easter weekend, Great Lakes and Northeast. Meanwhile, the warmth out west is going to continue, and the dry weather in the Southwest continues. Our meteorologist Dan Podnowski will be joining me at the end of the podcast with our weather for the upcoming weekend and week beyond, and we'll talk about all those things. And we're also going to talk about feeding and migrating birds and how you can follow this massive bird migration that's about to get underway, how that relates to the weather. Some interesting stuff here with our friends at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Friends, sit back and relax. It's time to talk about everything under the sun from AccuWeather.com. As we get underway with episode 7 of our spring series, if you may remember, we got back to our winter series, and the podcast that dropped back on January 28th was our first conversation with Senior Research Associate Dr. Andrew Farnsworth of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and got really excited about weather and bird migration. Had a lot of questions for Andrew then. And friends, we're getting really now on the cusp of an explosion of migration. Some of the most prolific times of bird migration from Central and Southern America, South America up towards us, Central America and Mexico and those areas, up through the United States and even into Canada. And this is a time when you should be checking out the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's amazing tool, which is called BirdCast. And you can get that by going to birdcast.info. In fact, as you're listening to the podcast, if you're able, you might want to pull that up on your screen a while. But if not, we'll tell you how to navigate that and all the amazing information that that will give us. And also, I think, I found out so many more, we call them teleconnections in meteorology about how if things are happening in one place, something else will happen in another place. I think we're seeing some connections about bird migration, how the weather can cause it or influence or vice versa. We can tell things about the weather from the migration of the birds. So let's join in with Dr. Andrew Farnsworth here on Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. Andrew, welcome back in. As I was telling you when we were setting up the interview, I had a lot of great reaction to our visit last time. I think, it's amazing to me how meteorologists and bird watching or bird enthusiasm seem to go hand in hand. I think it's because, there's such a direct corollary, especially when we're talking about seasonal changes in weather, and kind of gives us a little bit of clue of what's happening too by seeing what's happening with the birds. So from the meteorological friends that I have enjoyed it, and other friends too. So I really, I hope we can do this more and more often, because I told you before how much I love the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It's a great resource. So welcome back to Everything Under the Sun, and some exciting times here as we get into the heart of the season of migration for us in the Northern Hemisphere. We're seeing some things go away, some things coming in, and a lot of transients here this time of year, my friend.
Yes, absolutely. This is one of the most exciting times. Maybe some of it is colored by the fact that, we've all been through the northern winter for the most part. And in particular, in more northern latitudes, that usually means not so many birds and low diversity. And now this month, April in particular, is where that really starts to change. So this is an exciting time of the year. Obviously, from a meteorological perspective, there's a lot happening. And that's certainly part of the reason that migration is occurring as well, just sort of thinking about the connection between those two things. But it's a very exciting time of the year, absolutely. And we're really probably about 10 to 12 or 14 days away from kind of the first peak wave of bird migration, you know, entering the U.S. And that'll happen in the southern U.S. and gradually, you know, move north, much the same way as greening of vegetation or sort of the warming of temperatures. If you look at a map like that, there's this wave of peak migration. And really the beginning of that is going to be really sort of like in the 20s of April is when it's going to enter the southern part of the U.S. So
now
soon.
Does that change from year to year, or is that pretty consistent to the day, just like the day the Capistranos come back to San Juan, right?
The good swallows, yeah. There is some consistency to it from some perspectives, and there also is change that's happening. So let me explain a little bit. So the consistent part. So I mentioned that the wave really enters the southern U.S. These are birds that are coming from South America, Central America, the Caribbean, Mexico, where they've spent the northern hemisphere winter. Basically, they move there to avoid loss of food, cold weather, etc. And they spend their time in much warmer, better climates. And they're there for a lot of the year. And then in the spring, they're moving north. So that wave of migrants, that's the one that's coming in sort of like the third week in April. That's when that peak is first arriving. That timing tends to be very similar over the course of across years. We've looked at that, and there generally is some consistency there. But as you get farther and farther north, the pattern over the last 20 years or so is that peak is actually occurring earlier and earlier. So birds are, to some extent, speeding up once they get into the U.S. to try to sort of track temperature. You know, basically, temperature is one of these things that really defines spring migration in terms of increasing temperature, generally means increasing migration intensity. So there's this relationship between warming temperatures and tracking of migration. And of course, as those temperatures have warmed, say over the last 20 years, we see increasingly earlier arrivals of that peak wave. So yes, it does stay the same in some places. No, it changes pretty dramatically in others, to the tune of like 1 to 2 days per decade, even. So wow. Kind of extrapolate. So that's significant. So
that significant.
And that's kind of like if you take the sort of the northern border, right, the border with the U.S. and Canada,
right.
That's in the zone where that change of peak migration is occurring in that 1 to 2 days earlier per decade as a function of increasing temperatures.
It also means that species will stay longer farther north. As we're seeing some birds winter more farther north than they were, and that's probably a line that's creeping farther north every year as we go.
There are some really interesting patterns like that, absolutely, that depending on the species groups, right? For some species, we see them still leaving at the same times. For others, for example, turkey vulture is a great one, but a number of other sparrows, obviously a lot of waterfowl. If the temperatures are warmer and there is food available and they have the capability to migrate in what we call a facultative way, basically as is needed, right? And if they don't need to, they don't, right? And that propagates, that kind of change can propagate very quickly in a community when it comes to the change from being a, you know, really an intense migrant, an obligate migrant, as we say, that where the whole population may move, changing very quickly to a more sedentary or resident population, or one that at least only moves when it has to. Those kinds of changes can happen fairly quickly if you have the raw materials within those species and populations, like the numbers of birds and the variation captured in a population of species to accommodate that. It's not the case with every species, and it's not every bird can adapt that way.
So let me go back to the turkey vultures, because I live on a ridge line. Okay. So I look back and there's a couple of places where people can go and do the gliding because it's a good spot. So we get, but I'm seeing, you're right, not as much necessarily seasonal migration, but more movement in groups. And with vultures, they don't actually fly close together, but you stand there and one goes over, and about a minute or two later, another one. And then, and that could go five, six, you know, seven or eight vultures. So you're saying that that is one species that we've seen this less. When I was a kid, my dad took me to Hawk Mountain. Do you know
if
I've ever heard about that in southeastern Pennsylvania? Yeah.
Yes.
Beautiful, you know, and you know, the cry of TV over six. And that meant that there was bumps in the ridge and they had them numbered. And if there was a vulture, so there would be a person there with binoculars and calling out the birds as they migrated, what they were, osprey, eagles, hawks, red tail, and that kind of stuff. Really cool stuff. So, but I'm seeing that, you know, those kind of more, just as needed migrations and movements for depending on food, snow cover, but less big movement, right? Is that what you're saying with the vultures?
Yeah, and turkey vulture is an interesting one because it varies all over the. It obviously it's a widespread species in North America, and some of the birds that are involved as migrants are going all the way to the Amazon from parts, you know, far north in on the continent, while some are sticking around. So, for example, in Northeast U.S., the notion of warmer winters and also changing. Habitats, if you will, increases in the deer population, changing kinds of habitat that's supporting deer, more roadkill of deer, more availability of, you know, of scavenging foods that these vultures can take advantage of. All of these pieces of the puzzle, including the climate change part, are likely a part of what's going on. And so birds are adapting to that, right? So they can, there's enough flexibility in the strategies that turkey vultures use that, yeah, some of them you will see migrating past Hawk Mountain, you know, in October and into November, and those birds will be going into the southeast and accumulate in Florida and along the Gulf Coast and places like that, and then come back in the spring. But others, increasingly in the Northeast, are now spending time on the Palisades all winter long, you know, and in parts of northern New England and in the Great Lakes, where in the past, even as sort of recently as, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ago, that was a real rarity to see turkey vulture in the winter in a lot of these places. And that's not changed very dramatically. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Friends, we're talking with Dr. Andrew Farnsworth from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology here as we're talking about this exciting time. As you just said, we're about less than 2 weeks away from this first real push of huge migration from Central and South America up into the United States. And there's a way to follow this, and it's called BirdCast. You can go to birdcast.info, and this is basically a radar that is going to show you the amount of migration and information about that. Andrew, talk a little bit about this. This has been a project that gets better and better every year.
I'm glad to hear you say that. We like to think that it gets better and better every year too. BirdCast has been a really amazing collaborative initiative. There are a lot of partners involved, and it's really happened over the past 20 years. The original concept in the late 90s was this notion of being able to take radar, weather surveillance radar, in particular NEXRAD, the WSR-88D as it's called, weather surveillance radar 1988D designation. And that network of, there are 143 of them in the contiguous U.S. Those radars, they're incredible sensors in terms of monitoring the atmosphere. Meteorological and biological information is detected by these things. You know, so meteorologists will tell you, of course, that they want to remove the contamination of birds. You know, ornithologists and biologists, of course, will tell you, well, in fact, these are even better, you know, sensors for biodiversity than they are for weather. So we want to remove the weather part.
Right,
and
exactly.
Of course, the happy medium is that we need both of them to understand the dynamics and of the, you know, migration systems. And it's so regardless.
Well, tell you what, if you're a savvy meteorologist, you sometimes use the bugs or the birds or whatever it's picking up in terms of wind flow and stuff like that. I mean, there is actually some meteorological use to that on a dry day when you don't have anything falling from the sky.
That's right.
So, you know, some people are happy with anything. So, yeah, I like our medium, Andrew. So that's
we like the happy medium. Yeah. So the BirdCast has been all about this, this collaborative effort broadly between ornithologists and computer scientists. And that evolved because from a computer science perspective, there was tremendous interest when the first BirdCast project was funded by National Science Foundation, which that part happened about 14 years ago or so, something like that. There was tremendous interest in the computer science community of thinking about messy data and making predictions from messy data and trying to find collaborations where computer scientists could employ their knowledge to actually, you know, sort of advance a domain like biology, for example, where there are all sorts of messy data sets that one might want to predict and understand. Bird migration is a perfect example of one, and that was sort of the genesis of BirdCast that now has evolved to the point where we use machine learning to extract the meteorological signal from the radar data, leaving the biological signal, which during spring and fall migration, of course, is dominated by birds, and then quantify that, characterize when birds are on the move, where they're on the move, then relate that kind of information back to weather data to build models of migration forecasts, to do live maps of where birds are, you know, 15 or 20 minutes after the radar data are collected by the radar, so really close to real time. And then also using this new tool that we have this year, Migration Dashboard, to look kind of at the county level and think about, well, let's put a little bit more detail out there beyond just the forecast maps that we can make that look really nice for the continental U.S. and the observed maps for the continental U.S. Let's look at a county kind of level and see how many birds are on the move, what altitude they are, what direction and speed they're moving, wow, how that relates to historical patterns, and then related also to eBird data, to community science data, to show people, well, here are the birds that are contributing to these radar signals at night when most of the migration happens.
Now, are you also using, because another program that I take part in is the the Birdwatch program, the Feeder Watch program. Mm-hmm. Do you take that data in too, where you're looking at the BirdCast radar data and that information, and then are you kind of checking by seeing how people are reporting at their feeders what's going on? Is that something like a check and balance situation that you can do?
That's a good question. So we don't do it so much with the feeder data, because usually the bird feeding stations and the feeder watch data, they tend to highlight the species that are more resident or more sedentary. Obviously, not all of these birds move, and they can, you know, birds have wings and they fly. So it's not like it's always going to be resident birds. But if that project in particular is very much dominated by those kinds of patterns that aren't necessarily driven by these more dynamic species movers that are coming across, you know, really significant distances, and moving across the continent. So the kind of data that we do use observational data, it's just a different flavor than the feeder watch data per se. And it's the eBird data that I mentioned, where it's a little bit of a broader kind of a community science project where birders can submit information from wherever they are on the planet about what birds they see, how many, how much effort they put in, comments, photos, audio, etc. And we do look at that information and try to understand what the radar is telling us, which of course doesn't tell us what the species are, because it's just a pulse of microwave energy that sends out and obviously comes back, and fine-tuning that information. We don't have the capability. Maybe that exists in the very rawest form of the data. We don't have it. So we look at that as bird biomass without really a specific species name on it per se. But then when we relate it to the observational data, when people are out during the day observing, oh, what has arrived in my backyard, you know, after migrating last night, and what's not there the next day, those kinds of relationships between the observational data and what the radar are telling us, those are really important. And we do take advantage of those, definitely.
We're going to probably come back at some point, and I'd like to go into, the eBird thing is something I haven't thought about or getting into, but that sounds like fun.
It's great.
Feeder watch. And, I've been enjoying and looking at some stuff. You know, one thing just real quick, and then I want to just ask you a couple of other questions, more general topics here. Sure. I did notice as I look at the BirdCast that there was kind of a little pulse a few days ago.
Yes.
And that's from like the southeast up along the Appalachians.
Yep.
Is that the beginning of the pulse of some of those bigger migratory birds that we were just talking about?
It's the very earliest, sort of the first hint of the diversity of migration to come and the numbers to come. So, Okay. Yeah, you think about what's happened in the southeastern U.S. in particular over the last couple of days. There is obviously a very significant frontal boundary that is moving across the country right at the moment. And in front of that, to the east, right, it's real active and a lot of weather happening. It's
right.
Real
a big
stuff, right?
Southeast flow or southwest flow ahead of that. A lot of good wind to get a tailwind to start making that trip north. So
that's exactly right.
Sense that, right? It's like, you know, if we go now, we can catch the express.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they're going to run into some really strong west northwest wind. I mean, the Great Lakes. I mean, amazing.
I know, and snow even, and so this kind of movement, sort of embodies the challenges, in particular for these early migrants,
right,
and also for migrants dealing with climate change, right. So in terms of thinking, more extreme storms every spring, or various times through the year, of course, but more extreme storms, including these late snow and super intense mid-latitude cyclones, that are producing, freezing temperatures and a lot of snow in places where some of these arriving migrants have the, to anthropomorphize a little bit, the expectation, if you will, of food resources like insects and blossoming, right?
So they kind of think, oh, if it's getting warm and humid and, oh, wow, I'm going to get into a place where the midges are going to start hatching and we're all, about bugs and stuff. That's amazing to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. So these extreme freezes create enormous problems potentially. Right. For these early migrants. And so too, with these kinds of weather systems where you have this strong, return flow, sort of after the high pressure passes and you have these southerly winds in advance of these cold air masses, birds are taking advantage of that in the spring in incredible ways. And they're moving, enormous distances. Some birds that come into the U.S. from the Caribbean and from Northern South America, they're making a single leap from the continent, the sort of the last landmass, last land area, say in northern Colombia. They are, and sometimes able to make that leap, even a small bird like a great cheek thrush, all the way from there, into the Ohio River Valley. It's insane. It's absolutely unbelievable. And some of that has to do with really favorable conditions, including the circumglobal teleconnection, flow from sort of very low latitudes to high latitudes. There's some pieces of bird migration that are certainly connected to that kind of pattern, and birds taking these incredible leaps to go, thousands of kilometers. Other times, maybe they won't go so far, but they still want to try to take advantage of these tailwinds. So, of course, in the spring, in advance of a cold front passing, that's when you get that nice, supportive tailwind action that they'd like to take advantage of. And so that's what you've seen in the southeast in the past couple of days.
So that thrush that goes that many miles, how high is it up when it's doing that? And I'll tell you, when you can do that, there's a type of cloud that is formed. It's called a Rossby wave cloud.
Okay. Of course.
It's the ones that look like a Ruffles potato chip.
Yes.
Because that's when we're having tremendous amounts of transport of different air at the top and the bottom, and it's creating that kind of ripple effect in the middle.
That's right. And the Rossby waves it's a wonderful way to think about, broadly speaking, it's a longer time scale than just, say, birds migrating on a particular night. Obviously, it captures that to some extent, but it captures sort of the dynamics over time of when these pulses occur and what influences them from year to year. And then obviously over longer periods of time, these kind of regularized climatological patterns, that's one of the things that drives the evolution of bird migration, of course, and how it happens. So the altitude you ask about in terms of some of these thrushes, it's incredible. So they are, in some cases, moving around tremendously in the air column, and it could be on the order of 1,000, 2,000 meters in the course of a night, sort of looking for not necessarily the most optimal conditions, but kind of even... even the least unfavorable or the, you know, the sort of the most marginal conditions, like things that are kind of suboptimal, that are good, that are calm winds, even not necessarily the strongest tailwinds, but certainly supportive tailwinds help. Birds are moving around to the best kind of thing that they can find without expending the most energy that they can. So yeah, they may find, you know, and may migrate at 2,000 or 3,000 meters above the ground in some cases. When it comes to larger bodied birds, some thrushes may get up that high occasionally, but usually it's a little bit lower, like in the 500 to 1500 meter range. But there's a lot of information there, a lot of, you know, a lot of change that birds are trying to exploit, and a lot of variation, and then a huge amount of biomass that's happening, basically moving in that lowest 3,000 meters above the ground, in particular in the eastern U.S.
Think about a bird as like a pilot, you know, when you're in a plane and there's times when it's really choppy and the pilot will say, I'm going to try to move to a different altitude to get out of this. The same thing the bird's trying to do is find the right altitude that's giving them the favorable wind direction. And so, yeah, that's cool. And
that's absolutely
conditions too.
Yep, absolutely right. Very, very good analogy. And it's presumably one of the reasons that birds actually migrate at night is, in theory, the turbulence is a little bit more regularized, or at least it's less than it is during the day, right? In theory.
Yeah.
So that there are opportunities to take advantage of the regularized turbulence, or to just avoid the crazy turbulence that happens, obviously, with thermals during the day.
Dr. Andrew Farnsworth from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You know, it's that time of year again when, we're talking about bird migration, but, you know, people are kind of getting out from under winter. I know, you know, some people feed birds mainly in the winter because they feel bad for the birds, you know, especially in where places that are snowy and icy. Other people feed them all year round. I'm that person too. A couple of things. First of all, I was going to tell you with this, I have had a cluster of bluebirds that have stayed with me all winter.
Nice.
Help them with feeding them some mealyworms. They like that, and but it was fun to see them in there. And now the last couple of weeks have gotten so beautiful. I've also had cardinals. There seemed to be, the number of cardinals I have this year has exploded around me, to the point where they're starting to peck at the windows because they think they're seeing so many other cardinals close. I was sitting in the car after I pulled in the driveway last evening and was, you know, doing that thing we all do, is we look at our phone and answer texts for 5 minutes before we go inside. Right. And right. I hear this tap, tap, tap. I'm looking over and it's a cardinal. And I'm like, dude, I'm just in here chilling, you know, relax. Am I good to keep same level of feeding during the summer or spring into summer as I was doing in the winter? Should I change? What is there any guidelines to that, or just keep doing what you're doing? Don't think about the seasonality of feeding versus other things that we think about seasonality in terms of doing things differently.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So generally speaking, continuing to feed all year round, I think it's a great idea. The one change you might make is you might notice, obviously, with warming temperatures and increasing abundance of insects and other sorts of food that birds may target, is that the numbers may decline and that the amount of food that you have in the feeders sits around longer. So you just want to be sensitive about that, because obviously moldy food and places where that food can sort of produce non-sterile conditions and you end up with some sort of bacterial growth or fungal growth or that kind of thing. You don't want to have that. So as long as feeding all year round, absolutely fine. You know, and birds will certainly take advantage of that, no question. But just monitoring that in terms of how much birds are eating and how much is left and just sitting there, that's an important component. And then also realizing that because there are all of these other potential resources that, yeah, you may lose some birds to, you know, to other things, but you may keep a lot for the entire cycle, for the entire, you know, the spring, summer, fall. You may see those birds that you've been feeding continuing to return to the feeders. And if it so happens that you, for some reason, stop feeding, the birds aren't going to die. They're very adept at finding food wherever they can find food. They are very adaptable when it comes to that point.
Absolutely.
So keeping all those things in mind, definitely keep feeding all year, but just be mindful about the amount and that you may have, you may have more seeds sitting around. So you just want to be careful about that.
I also try to go more holeless, go cleaner in the spring and the summer. And then also be careful because obviously things that drop in the places this time of year, they can germinate. Before you know it, you can have a lot of weeds or grasses.
Massive sunflower.
Yeah, well, right. And then I've been good at really working on trying to find the species that grow and don't have issues. Dahlias don't have issues. Vinca, I could go on. We were talking about this with our gardening guy the other day.
Yep.
One other quick update. Avian flu. Bird flu, where, I'm starting to see some articles, people getting concerned about numbers.
Yeah.
Maybe what your thoughts on that are as we go here into the late spring and summer.
Yeah. So obviously, it's become quite a serious concern in that it's expanding rapidly in many areas of the eastern U.S. It's probably more widespread than we know. And the transmission that we've, I think, seen so far, and the APHIS, the USDA website has a lot of information about that if you visit it, about where the surveillance is finding wild birds in particular. It's dominated by waterfowl that are having these infections, and that presumably is the source of transmission that obviously between the movements of waterfowl in February, March, and April, that the progression of the transmission events farther and farther north and west as these birds are moving, and then having them encounter places where that transmission can then carry over into poultry, right? And into poultry farms. We've seen that time and time again, and it's definitely increasing now. And it probably is going to increase over the course of the year. And then, of course, in the fall, we're going to see another big pulse of it. Now, hopefully, the monitoring is good and the surveillance is good, and the understanding of sort of what's going on starts to be a little more robust than it's been. Obviously, it's been an increasing and important PR campaign to understand that it's happening and to have poultry engaged in biosecurity and biosurveillance at their facilities. Thankfully, there has not been any bird-to-human transmission in the U.S., and let's hope it stays that way. But obviously, it can still be an enormous problem, like a billion or multi-billion dollar problem for the poultry industry if this continues and expands. So it's something that it's very difficult to potentially control it. Obviously, there are all sorts of unpalatable kinds of things that spread from it beyond just the potential transmission to humans, which thankfully hasn't happened in North America. But it's just it's just something to be mindful of and to really watch, definitely.
Seems to me too, Andrew, that it with us, being so COVID focused, that I think that's going to continue to create focus more on regular flu and regular influenza and this situation. So hopefully, maybe in some ways a little bit too focused on it with people. I don't know, but you can't. I mean, this is, you're right. This is something you can't be careful enough with. And it's definitely something to keep monitoring, keep yourself informed.
Definitely.
Just checking around. And I think, especially too with your local health organizations as well, state and local levels mostly as well.
Yes, and make sure, if you are, for whatever reason, if you find dead birds or see them, don't handle them if you can avoid it. And if you must, of course, wear a mask and gloves. Better to talk to a professional, a wildlife rehabber or your state wildlife office, animal control, that kind of thing, because you just don't want to. This is exactly the situation, presumably, where, we had the initial issue with COVID and that sort of transmission of a zoonotic disease, right? Something that affects animals other than humans that transmits one way or another into the human human population. We don't want to have that happen here, you know, if we can avoid it. So just being careful if you see dead birds anywhere, anything like that, or if you happen to handle poultry, if you have chickens in your backyard, just be very mindful about being careful with your protective gear. You should have it on and use it.
Dr. Andrew Farnsworth from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, thanks so much. Looking forward to watching Birdcast at birdcast.info.
Yeah.
Next time we have you on, I want to get information about eBird, and we'll talk about that and catch up to date on the latest news. I'm like to think that you're part now of the Everything Under the Sun family, and we're going to welcome you back a few more times soon. Okay, my friend?
I appreciate that. Thank you for the opportunity and, you know, for these great questions and discussion. I look forward to the next time.
Well, I think a lot of my meteorological friends are going to just kind of geek out on those connections, those avian connections between the weather and migration and how we see and how we think about that. It's really good stuff. Thanks, Andy.
Yeah, well, make sure they visit the website, you know, and there's a lot of information there, and they can always reach out to us, you know, to ask questions and provide information. There's a lot happening, and this is the busy time. So real exciting stuff.
Really, really fascinating stuff from Andrew, and we hope that you can take advantage of looking at their website, especially that Birdcast display is amazing, and you're seeing so much of it going on here in the last couple of days already, and then, as Andrew said, it's only going to get more colorful and more informative, and again, you can go to that link at birdcast.info, and we've got links to Andrew's website and his Twitter account and everything else that you need to know on our show notes here on our Everything Under the Sun podcast. Friends, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go into our weather for the upcoming weekend and week beyond segment with our friend Dan Pidanowski from AccuWeather. This is Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
Plan your day with confidence and find out what the weather means for you. Join AccuWeather meteorologist Bernie Reno Monday through Friday for Weather Insider. Available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. I'm your host, meteorologist Dean DeBoer. As we continue on here in spring, an amazing conversation with Dr. Andrew Farnsworth about weather and bird migration. And I just wanted to bring in one of my favorite compatriots here at AccuWeather, who's also a fellow bird feeder himself. He's not a bird feeder. He feeds the birds. His name is Dan Pidanowski. And Dan, senior meteorologist for us, and now our chief morning meteorologist and forecaster here at AccuWeather. And Dan and I have been pairing bird feeding and watching notes for several years here as we've worked together. Dan, some really interesting stuff. Now, I know you haven't heard the whole interview, and I was kind of previewing it from it, but it's amazing here as we get ready for this influx of amazing amounts of migration here over the next couple of weeks. We're already seeing some of that. If you look at the radar that the folks at Cornell provide, and it's kind of crazy because it really goes along in what we've been seeing here this week, which is a lot of wind coming off from the southwest to northeast ahead of a front. Some real warm temperatures finally into the northeast as we got into the end of the week. But unfortunately, it looks like a kibosh being put on all of that here as we go into the weekend with another extremely chilly air mass, Dan, that's going to be coming in to the Great Lakes and Northeast. I mean, folks are going to wonder if it really is April and Easter, because it's going to feel a lot colder than it should. And there's some white stuff in the forecast, not Easter eggs, but maybe hunting some snowflakes on Easter Sunday morning in some parts of the Great Lakes in the Northeast. Kind of crazy stuff we got going on here in the next couple of days.
Yeah, that's exactly right. April always a back and forth month, and what we're seeing over the next few days certainly an example of that. Well into the 80s in a lot of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic yesterday. What was it, 88 at Newark, and now we're talking about highs back into the 40s. It'll be chilly Sunday morning in a lot of places for sunrise services. So. Yeah, back and forth we go. And unfortunately, if you like the warm weather, it looks like the cold stuff's going to be winning out here, at least maybe into the first half of next week before maybe finally things moderate a little bit.
Yeah, I think this is that's kind of the depressing part. I mean, yeah, you're right. We expect some pushes of cold air in April and even into May, early May. We were talking about that in the office. Mother's Day weekend, parts of the Great Lakes in the Northeast, not immune to some snow showers or a little bit of light snow. And that may be the situation that we see over the next few weeks into then, where we still see some cold incursions. But this one, it's just long lasting. You're right. Like place like I looked at Chicago, where I'm on a WBBM in the mornings. I mean, low 50s today, 40s, pretty much to near 50 the rest of the Easter weekend and into the first couple of days of next week. I mean, you could expect that normally 1 or 2 days in a row this time of year, but certainly not 4 or 5. And that's kind of what makes this kind of depressing for those of us who want the warm and sunny winds of April and May, right?
Yeah. And of course, what we had earlier this week makes it all the worse because it was 72 in Chicago a few days ago. So again, you've had this nice warm up. You've had a nice taste of spring. You had a lot of areas with temperatures above normal. And now we're swinging it back the other way. And you're right. It's a prolonged 4 or 5 day stretch of it. So that makes it tougher to swallow when you've had that 70 and 80 degree days. And now you're getting back into the 40s and 50s.
Now, the cold air had been pushed back to the west. In fact, some storminess out there. Kind of give me your take on the western states here as we go into this upcoming weekend and the week beyond. Some things to look for there, some highlights out west.
Yeah, certainly interesting weather across parts of the West over the last few days. Portland picking up accumulating snow in April. That's I think that might be the first time on record officially at the airport. So very unusual weather across parts of the Pacific Northwest. And it looks like over the next few days, Pacific Northwest stays active, probably low snow levels again tomorrow around Portland and Seattle, very cold air mass in place and getting some much-needed rain in northern and central California, it looks like, tomorrow, and then some mountain snow for the Sierra. So that's, of course, good news. Unfortunately, for SoCal, it looks like everything is going to the north. So Los Angeles, San Diego, the LA Basin, unfortunately going to be missing out on the rain. And of course, we're running out of time. If we're not getting any kind of rain in LA now, we're pretty much at the end of the opportunity of that as we head out of the wet season and into the dry season.
Yeah, it is awfully scary. I agree, Dan, where we're looking at this scenario and it just looks like it could ignite as like a tinderbox here at times over the next couple of months. You know, that energy that we're seeing out west going to take a turn into the south here as we get Friday night into Sunday. And I want to jump forward because I think along the eastern seaboard, there is the potential for a nor'easter to bring some really, well, awful chilly rain and wind along the eastern seaboard itself. And then as you bring some of that colder air to bear from the north, there could be some mix in or even some just plain snowflakes in some of the interior parts of the northeastern New England. But, you know, it's early in the scenario here. We're dropping this podcast, obviously, on Friday, early in the modeling run on this. But one of the concerns I always have in these scenarios is if we have an area of low pressure like this along the eastern seaboard, how much are the models not telling us how much it's going to deepen as it goes along in this the life of it? So I think for folks along anywhere from Jersey Shore communities up to the tri-state area of New York along the eastern seaboard, then up into the New England areas, you got to be taking a look at this for later Monday into Tuesday and maybe making some plans for at least a pretty healthy dose of wind and rain, especially along the coast.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that energy in the northern branch of the jet stream is just coming on to the West Coast now. That's what we were talking about, bringing some rain to the Pacific Northwest tonight into tomorrow. And that's going to come quickly eastward into the Great Lakes on Monday. And you're right. Meanwhile, another area of low pressure developing in the southeast. And that's what we call phasing of the jet streams when the northern and southern branch come together and eventually the main storm center takes place off the mid-Atlantic coast and comes northward. How quickly that happens, where exactly that happens, you're right, Dean, there's difference in the modeling about the intensity of the phasing and exactly where it comes together. So we're confident there's going to be a storm to deal with Monday into Tuesday, but exactly how intense dense it is, how strong it is, that remains to be seen. But you're right, I-95, certainly I-95 cities from D.C. all the way up to Boston certainly could be dealing with some wind and rain. And it is going to be cold enough in the interior that certainly in the mountains and maybe even in some valley locations from PA northeastward into New England and eastern Canada, we could be talking about late season snowfall. So 70s and 80s a couple days ago, and now we're talking about the opportunity for snow after Easter, no less.
Danny, you're depressing me and the folks listening here on Everything Under the Sun. Let's turn this back to something a little more fun. I know that you and I share the love of feeding and watching birds. I've been seeing some things. We were talking about this with Andrew. It seems like there are more birds that are spending the winter here now because of our maybe less harsh winters over the last couple of decades. I've had some bluebirds at my feeder all winter long. Anything interesting that you've noticed here over the last year or so feeding birds and being around, especially with all of us spending a little more time at home over the last couple of years with the pandemic, working from home? I think I'm a little bit more sensitive to what's going on, but always good. And this bird migration stuff with BirdCast, the radar that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology does, is just amazing to see how they kind of tie together the weather and the birds. It makes it for a geeky, fun thing for me who likes both the weather and the birds.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I just filled up the bird feeder the other day. Obviously, they go through the food very quickly this time of year. They're very busy getting ready to build their nests. And
I'm already seeing some robin eggs. In some places already. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And maybe next week or maybe after this cold shot early next week, I'll take a chance and put up the Oriole and hummingbird feeders. We were looking at some maps the other day in the office. There's already been some sightings in southeastern PA in the lower Susquehanna Valley. So getting pretty close to us. So I may take a shot at it this weekend and put the hummingbird feeder up and see if I get an early one.
Just take it down at night, because Danny and I both live in a place where we've been dealing with some bears overnight roaming about. Yeah,
I've had that the last couple of years. They've hit them.
For sure. Dan Pinowski, thanks for joining us with a look at the weather for the upcoming weekend and week beyond here on Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. Friends, that'll do it for Episode 7 of our spring series. Many thanks to our guests, including Dr. Andrew Farnsworth from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Dan Pinowski. Thanks to our hundreds of team members who work hard every hour of every day, weatherproofing your life with the latest information on AccuWeather.com, our AccuWeather apps, and our network, and our great media partners across the nation. We'll be back next week with Everything Under the Sun, giving you information and stories where the weather meets your life. And certainly, if you've got suggestions or comments or questions, give us a shout on our email, podcast@AccuWeather.com. Pretty simple. podcast@accuweather.com. You can send us your questions, comments, or suggestions for future topics. For our executive producers, Ken Prell and Andrew Robb, I'm your host, Dean DeVore. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on our next episode of Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe to, rate, and review Everything Under the Sun on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And of course, if you have an idea for a future podcast, just email us at accuweather.podcast@accuweather.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.